Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Now, Hyakujo, he was an old-time Zen master long ago in China. One day he called all his monks together as he wished to open a new monastery, and somebody had to be in charge of it. So what he did, he placed a filled water jug on the ground, and then he said, "Who can say what this is without using its name?" And the chief monk, who expected to get the position, said, "Well, no one can call it a wooden shoe." And another monk said, "Well, it's not a pond because it can be carried." The cooking monk, who was standing off to one side, he walked out and he kicked the jar over and he walked away, and saying something, you know, "This is absurd." And Hyakujo smiled and he said, "Well, the cooking monk becomes the abbot of the new monastery." Yeah. Now, in the discipline that is called Zen, this discipline is sometimes called meditation hall, in which we have all the regulations of the meditation hall, the discipline that is peculiar to Zen. And the basic rules and regulations, the basic discipline, this was all written out, all these regulations were written out by Hyakujo more than 1,000 years ago. What he wrote originally has been lost, but as they were already practicing it, someone in later times wrote it out again. But the meditation hall, in looking at it, it becomes rather like the term sangha, the brotherhood that exists. And, you know, it's the vital element in the lives of the monks. They have manual labor, you know, they have sweeping and cleaning and cooking and gathering wood and anything for fuel, and they till the soil, or they go begging, you know. No work is beneath their dignity. Yeah. This work ethic that they have, you know, and the companies in Japan, they send their employees for training, you know, 6 weeks, 6 months, even a weekend every now and then, to get this work ethic. And it stems from Hyakujo. He is the one, you know, he was getting pretty old. He was around 90 and bumbling around and still working out in the garden. And the monks didn't want him to work so hard, so they hid his garden tools. And he is the one who said, "No work, no eat." And he refused to eat until they gave him back his tools. This kind of a thing, you know, no work, no eat. And some people think that it is this approach which now stems, goes, it flows all the way through Zen, you know, that it is this that saved the movement from deteriorating into some kind of intellectual gymnastics because of the little koan, the problems, you know. and, you know, so that it preserved the health and the sanity of Zen. This is Hyakujo's very profound insight into human psychology. We use muscles, our body, use the mind, and use the two as one. Hyakujo, huh? Now, in Thessalonians, in the Christian Bible, we also find the words, if any would not work, neither should he eat. See? Now, I don't know if it's of any interest to you, but this is the first rule, this quote from this phrase from Thessalonians, this is the first rule that St. Francis set out when he set out the rules of his brotherhood, the Franciscans. No work, no eat. And you know, there's so many stories about some of these people. One day, or it was in the morning, and the monks asked Hyakujo if he would give a sermon about his understanding. And he was a very famous Roshi. And he said, well, if you will work on the farm all day today, then this evening I will give you a sermon on my understanding. So when it came time for the sermon, you know, he stood up and he went. Sermon. That's a lot of understanding. You know? The total, huh? Yeah. Now, we hear so often, you answer without a word, without a thought, without a concept, such as the question, who am I? Without a word, without a thought, who are you? Without a word, without a thought, without a concept, what is reality? Now, in the practice of Zen, reality is shown. You show it through action. Reality is known through action and not through the thinking. Actions are reality. When you act, if you can act without, you know, encumbering yourself with how you shoulds and should nots. But like the baby burped a little minute ago, very natural. That's reality. You're total. And the whole being is involved in this action. Thinking gives you only part of you. Thinking is part of you. It's the mind. But the whole is not involved. You don't even have to be very alert to think. Thinking just goes on and on and on and on. The mind churns and grinds. But, you know, suddenly you find that you have entered the picture, and you pick up a thought here, and you pick up a thought there. And it'd be through association. This one goes with this, and this one goes with this, and this one goes with this. Oh, look, I've got a concept. Or something to that effect. You don't say that, but that's you. Something in you is satisfied. But who are you? In this picture of picking and choosing thoughts, what are you? Do you even know that you're picking and choosing thoughts? Do you know what you are or who you are when you pick and choose? In the Isha Upanishad, it begins, all this is for the habitation by the Lord. Whatsoever is individual universe of movement in the universal motion. Now this term, the word habitation, all this is for the habitation by the Lord. In this particular translation, which is Sri Aurobindo's, it comes from the Sanskrit vasyam, and that means to be clothed, you know, to wear something as a garment, to be inhabited, lived in. And to be clothed, then, the ordinary accepted meaning is the Lord is clothed with all of this. All this is for the habitation by the Lord. Yeah. There are those in throughout the world, and Shankaracharya was one of them, in his explanations about this phrase, said that we must lose our sense of this unreal objective universe in order to perceive pure Brahman. But the Upanishads, you know, they have as their very basis the reconciliation of the seeming opposites, such as God and world. We think of them as opposite. They're not in reality opposite. See? Action and freedom, one and many, being and its becomings, they're not opposite. Knowledge and ignorance is not opposite. Becoming and not becoming. Yeah? Life on this earth and the supreme immortality are not opposites. So the Isha Upanishad, it starts right off with that. It's just really tremendous. It has as its image the world, this as the dwelling place for the informing spirit. And the Isha Upanishad, by the way, is considered the greatest of them all, of all the Upanishads, with the Kina Upanishad following, I think, very close on its heels. You know, the Kina Upanishad, at whose behest does the mind think? Yeah. Whatsoever is individual universe of movement in the universal motion. We move, we act, the individual, your individual universe, your individual motion is part and parcel of the universal movement. But we don't hardly ever think about that, do we? That every time we move, it affects the whole. It affects the totality. And this is what Zen keeps coming back to time after time after time after time. Being and becoming a universal oneness. The universe as such as it is, it doesn't think. It is movement, it is motion, it is action. And this is very basic for those who want to understand the truth. It is movement. That in this world we have religion and philosophy. Philosophy is the thinking and religion is the act. Now, this Hyakujo, he wanted somebody, one of his monks, to become abbot of a new monastery. Whom should he send? Who should become the guide? A man who has a great deal of philosophy in his mind, who can discuss things he can talk about, or a man who can act spontaneously. You know, maybe a very simple soul, but a total soul. One who can be total in action, be it walking or eating or sleeping. And this chief monk, he must have started speculating around, kind of dreaming a bit, And because he was a chief monk, he certainly thought, well, certainly I should be chosen. I am the chief here. It's very logical that the Roshi should choose me. It's rather natural that the ego thinks that way, because the ego is, after all, ambitious. Wei Ning, and when he became the sixth patriarch, he also ran into difficulties because of a chief monk. But anyway, this particular chief monk must have planned how he was going to behave and what he should do in order to be chosen. And maybe he didn't sleep very much that night for his mind churning around, making plans. What he was going to do when he was the abbot. We jump over an awful lot of things, right? Sure. See, the ego plans. And because it sits in its planning, it misses reality. Reality can only be encountered spontaneously. If you think about the situation beforehand, you may think you are prepared, but you miss the moment. You sit for meditation, and you feel pretty good about it, And you say to yourself, well, now I feel pretty good. I'm going to sit. I feel like sitting. Today I'm ready. Lord, I'm ready, Today I am prepared. Today I can meet reality. I'm not afraid today. Here I am, Lord. Come and get me, And you know what? You're disappointed. He didn't come. No. But if you just sit, just sit, spontaneously it comes, without any of your planning. Just sitting. Just sit without all of your discussions. If you just sit, you can enter the heart of reality. Me is already there, Get out of the way with these plans. Now, this chief disciple, he must have theorized. Alternatives must have come to his mind. The master is going to choose. In order for him to choose, there's got to be some sort of a test. And for long centuries, Roshis have been choosing monks in order to send them to new monasteries. Supposing now we were going to start having classes over in the other building also, we would have some kind of test to see who was going to be over there, be the abbot of that building, Plan away. See, you've already planned. You can't do that. Well, how did these Roshis choose? What sort of an examination did the monks have to take? It's like the monk over there, he goes along far enough and he has to take an examination in order to become a Roshi. What sort of an examination do they have to take? There's a lot of stories about these Zen masters. They put something in front of the monk and say something about this, but don't use the name of it. The name is not the thing, but say something about it without using the name. And the old one, if you call this a stick, you miss the reality. If you don't call it a stick, you miss the empirical fact. Quick, quick, quick. Now, what is it? And the chair is there, huh? So the master says, say something about the chair. But don't use a name. Don't use a name, chair, but say something about the chair. Don't use any verbal expression. And the mind here is very puzzled. The mind only knows language. If language is a no-no, no thought, no concept, no word, then mind is no-no. What else is in the mind except names and words and language? You got something else in your mind? You do? You don't? You do? You something else in your mind besides language? The word God is not God. And the word man is not man. And the word rose is not a rose. The rose, the man, and God do not depend on language. They are without language. You do exist without language, don't you? Once in a while. Anyway, this chief disciple, he chose what he was going to say. And in that moment, he failed. If reality is this ever-flowing movement, and Heraclitus said, you know, you can't step into the same river twice. It just, life flows. It is this motion, and no one knows what's going to happen next. You don't know what's going to happen in the next moment. You cannot predict what life is going to give you 5 minutes from now. The little story, I've told different versions of it, but the two monasteries that are side by side, and the Roshis, or the abbot of the monasteries, each one of them had a little boy that used to do their errands. And they would go to the market to fetch the vegetables and the other things, the bottle of beer or whatever the Roshi wanted. Two little boys, they were friendly rivals. Each, of course, thought their monastery was the best. Each thought that their Roshi was the best. And boys will be boys, you know. They would meet on the way, and they would talk, and they would enjoy each other's company. They weren't supposed to talk, but, you know. Anyway, one day, the boy from the first monastery, you know, he came to his Roshi, and he said, I'm very puzzled. As I was going to market with the boy from that monastery over there, and I asked him, you know, where are you going? And he said, wherever the wind blows. And I was at a loss what to say. What do you say to that? You know. And the Roshi said, this isn't good. No one from our monastery has ever been defeated by anybody from that monastery over there. So tomorrow, you ask again where he's going. And when he says, wherever the wind blows, you say, well, if there is no wind, then what? You know, and the little boy, he practiced that all night. He had this conversation, and he rehearsed it. You know, he would ask, and the other would respond, and he got all these responses, you know, so he could answer it back to him. And the next day, he's walking down the road, and the other little boy came along, and he asked, where are you going? And the other boy says, wherever my feet lead me. Okay. All his rehearsal didn't do him one bit of good. Huh? So his answer was fixed. And reality is unpredictable. So he came back to his Roshi and told him the situation. And the Roshi said, well, next day, when he answers, wherever my feet lead me, you ask him, well, if you're crippled and your legs are cut off, then what? And again, he didn't sleep very well. He's rehearsing all night long. And he went very early up the road. And when the boy came along, he says to him, "Where are you going?" The boy says, "I'm going to buy vegetables." See, the first little boy, that second little boy, the boy from the other monastery, is a good monk. And you know, life is very like that boy. Life isn't a fixed phenomenon. What happens today isn't going to happen tomorrow. Oh, you sit, you know, and it's wonderful, and you think, well, tomorrow I'll start just exactly where I left off. Ha, 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 ha. No such thing. No. Today is today. You live with today. Just live with today. You cope with today. Then you can cope with tomorrow when it comes. And it won't come because it'll be today. There was like the man that came to see the Buddha year after year after year after year he came to see him. And he always asked him the same question. But he never got the same answer year after year after year. Sometimes there was a smile. Sometimes he was met with just silence. And sometimes a yes and sometimes a no. So finally he said to the Buddha, "If you know, you know what it's all about. If you know, then you know, and your answer should always be the same." And the Buddha said very kindly to him, "It can't be. When you came for the first time asking, 'Is there God?' I answered, but not to the question. The answer was for you. Now you've changed. Same answer can't be given. You know, the river, the Ganges River, has flowed and flowed through all those years. You're not the same. I am not the same. And I also am not a book to be opened and the same answer is always found there. A river is not a painting. It is a live force. Painting remains the same, be it winter, be it summer, be it autumn, be it spring. A painting is the same. A painted river isn't going to flood in the spring or dry up in the summer. Outside of paintings and the words in a book, everything else is impermanent. Life goes on and on and on and on, a universal movement, which is not outside of you. Now this Roshi, this was his test. He put the jug of water on the ground there before the monks, and he says, "Say something about it, but don't use its name. Say something, but don't use your mind. Without a thought, without a concept, say something about that jug of water. Yeah. Say something, but don't use any language." It sounds silly, you know. Say something, but don't use any language. It really creates an impossible situation, you know. How can something be said without using language? If you can't say something about a little ordinary jug filled with water sitting there without using any language, how are you going to be able to say anything about God who fills this universe? If you can't indicate that jug without language, how are you going to be able to indicate the great jug, which is the universe? If you cannot indicate this jug, then how can you be the abbot of a monastery? People come to a monastery not to know words. They come to know reality. That's the purpose of a monastery. You want to learn words, you go to university. You want to learn reality, you go to a monastery. You learn existence, not theories. And if you can't say anything about a little pot, you know, what are you going to do when somebody says, what is God? If somebody says, who are you? What are you going to do with it? Well, it's not a wooden shoe. Well, what kind of an answer is that? It isn't a wooden shoe. You don't even have to mention it. Well, it's not a pond because it can't be carried. And what kind of an answer is this? It isn't. And here comes this cook now. He says, this is absurd. And he kicks the jug and he leaves. Kicking isn't thinking. No, it's an action. You know, he caught the point. There is something that can be done without words. And the Roshi said, you know, he's the abbot of the new monastery. He knows how to act without the mind. You know, he said, this problem is absurd. And the problem is absurd. See, without a word, without a thought, without a concept, which simply means with no ego, because the ego is a concept, without a word, before your mother and father were, what was your original face? Anyway, this monk, this cooking monk, you know, he just, because he got the point. He was involved, totally involved, mind and body one. And the kick was alive. You know. He may have even thought later on, I didn't answer anything. He was just seeing what was going on. He went out and he kicked it. All of a sudden it happens. You know. Because in this state, without the thinking about it, there is just this action. And the action comes out of what we call emptiness. Out of that no mind, emptiness, action comes. When the action comes from the actor, it's dead. When the action comes from the ego, it's premeditated. When the action comes without ego, without the thinking, then it just bubbles up and it's a living thing. It's universal. It's total. And then this cooking monk walked out. Yeah? He didn't wait for any results. He didn't wait to see whether he'd been right or wrong, because his ego was not involved. You know, it's like Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, do, act. Don't look for results. You know, Arjuna is there in this chariot with Krishna. And he is of the warrior caste. And on that side of the field are his uncles and brothers and cousins and, you know, so on and so on. And this side over here is his army. And he looks at all these people, and he knows some of them are going to be hurt and some of them are going to die. And he's sick at heart with the whole thing, all this battle for nothing, really. And he drops his bows and arrows and says to Krishna, I will not fight. And of course, Krishna tells him he has to because he's a warrior. And, you know, it starts out with Krishna says, "Thou grievest where no grief should be. Thou speakest words lacking wisdom," and on and on. But then he goes on to say, "Hear now the deeper teaching of the yoga, which holding, understanding, thou shalt burst thy karma bond, the bondage of wrought deeds. Here shall no end be hindered, no hope marred, no loss be feared. Faith, yes, a little faith, shall save thee from the anguish of thy dread. Here shines one rule," meaning in the faith, "one steadfast rule, while shifting souls have laws many and hard. Specious, but wrongful deem the speech of these ill-taught ones who extol the letters of the Vedas, saying, this is all we have nor need. Being weak at heart with wants, seekers of heaven, which comes, they say, as fruit of the good deeds done, promising men much profit in new births for works of faith, in various rites abounding, following whereon large merit shall accrue towards wealth and power, albeit who wealth and power do most desire, least fixity of soul have such, least hold on heavenly meditation. But thou, be free of the pairs of opposites, and free from that sad righteousness which calculates. Self-rule, Arjuna, simple, satisfied. Look, like as when a tank pours forth water to suit all needs, so do these Brahmins draw texts for all wants from tank of holy writ. But thou, want not, ask not. Find full reward of doing right in right. Let right deeds be thy motive, not the fruit which comes from them. Live in action. Make thine acts thy piety, casting all self aside, contemning gain and merit, equable in good or evil. Equability is yoga, is piety. That's Krishna. He says, don't think about a reward. Us with our sad righteousness. Leave the result to me, he says. You act. Difficult. We want to know the results. People ask, you know, if I should meditate, what's going to happen? What will happen to me if I meditate? What will be the result? If I come to church, what will be the result? Well, meditation is not result-oriented. You just meditate. That's all. That's all. Everything happens, but never as you planned. If you're planning, you're not ever going to see it. No. Life is very uncertain. Life is spontaneous. Life is moving. Why aren't we? We're afraid. The answer that I give could be wrong. Oh, how we stumble over that. Oh, man. I ought to know. So it's much better to decide ahead of time, you know, what to say, rather than leaving it for the moment. You know, but you might try it now and then, a little bit, you know. Maybe you'll be a little uncomfortable in the beginning, But you just allow it, you know, allow the discomfort. Don't hide, you know, be innocent. And it's like the man who one day he came home from work and he saw all his kids, all his children, and all the neighborhood kids. They're all sitting on the front steps of his house. And they're all sitting there very quietly. They should be running and jumping and playing here. They're sitting very quietly. And he says to them, "What are you doing?" "We're playing church." And this threw him a little bit. "What kind of church is this, just sitting here like this?" And said one of the children, "We have sung and we have preached and we have prayed. All has been done. Now we're sitting on the steps smoking." Every Monday and Wednesday. You know, we read something out of the Bible, or we read something that the Buddha has said, and we have our interpretation of it, our state of consciousness at that time. Have you ever noticed you read something, and all of a sudden there's this insight? I had this happen to me several times. I could read a particular book, and this is before I got into this thing, and I would, this thing happened to me, and the effect of it lasted about 6 weeks, and I would go back to this book, and I would read this passage, this page and a half, again and again and again and again, and nothing ever happened. No, I wanted it back again. So you sit there and you, the middle of the night, you're sitting here. No. So, but about 10 years later, I picked up the book. I'm reading a different page. Something else happened. Huh? My, how many times I read that? Never happened again. What you read is your state of consciousness. Now, if you let something happen, you know it will. But if you're sitting there, this is what we usually do. We read it and we interpret what we're reading. And we like it. Words. Huh? And we cram those in our heads. And then we play church. Hmm? We sing, we preach, we pray. Yeah? Little cooking monk, you know, he was innocent. Innocence is meditation. So we carry meditation with us. We're meditative in our acts, little things, you know. We're spontaneous in little things. When we talk, somebody's going to get angry with you now and then. But, you know, in your spontaneity. And when you walk, forget yourself. Walk. Be spontaneous. Be innocent. Huh? Allow life to respond to you. Don't have everything ready-made answers. Yeah? You know, we repeat so much out of habit, you know. And everyone is boring to everybody else. But we could practice a little. I could even say, try it. You like it. There was this new preacher. And he had been given a church. And comes the time now for his first Sunday talk. And so, of course, he rehearsed all week. He wrote it out, what he was going to say, and he rehearsed it. I mean, after all, this is a crisis in his life. This is the first time he's going to talk to this congregation, and it's succeed or fail. Yeah. And of course, the first success or the first failure is of tremendous import. It's a big deal, getting up there in front of a congregation for the first time. And so he rehearsed. He stood in his room, and he practiced. And he rehearsed what he was going to say. He's lecturing to the congregation. And in the morning, he was so tired, and he was so sleepy, he got up and stood at the pulpit, and his mind just went blank. Yeah. The passage that he had chosen to talk about, really quite tremendous. It was, "Behold, I come." So he started out with, "Behold, I come." Blank. There was nothing in there. And he thought, well, I guess I better repeat that. Maybe the flow will start. So he leans way out now, because he's appearing, he thinks, nonchalant. You know, "Behold, I come." Nothing. So now he's acting this thing out. He's going to, you know, this is all part now of the lecture. And he leans out very heavily, you know, across the pulpit, and he says, "Behold, I come." And the whole pulpit collapsed. And he fell into the lap of an elderly woman sitting in the first row. And he says, "Oh, I am so sorry." And she says, "No, you don't be. You did, after all, warn me 3 times. She was with it. Yeah. You know, one of the reasons we sit for meditation is to break out of the mold that we have created for ourselves. You know, we want to break out and be spontaneous. Yeah. To sit for meditation, to break out of the mold, this nice that you have created for yourself, you know, to break out of that is one of the most courageous things you can do. To want to learn to live in a responding, whatever the consequences. To live in this present. To have this moment as the totality of being. To be able to kick that pot and walk out, not waiting for a reward. Only this moment. Instead of trying to figure out both ends, you know, and all we find is paradoxes. And in existence, in this moment, there is nothing paradoxical. Because in this moment, now, everything is now. And now is the day of the Lord. Yeah? Okay. And now may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much for coming.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.